All right, if you would be turning to Romans chapter 1, that's where we're going to start our study this morning. Before we talk about anything else, we need to talk about this topic that it says on your schedules. I think I've had more questions about what this means than any of the other topics. The last couple of years, Jason assigned me a topic that I didn't know anything about, and this time he outdid himself by not assigning me a topic at all. And I was just as baffled as you are when I first saw it, and I went to Christopher Jaggi and I said, "Christopher, look at this topic. Can you make sense of this for me? You know, select archaeological discoveries, blah 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 blah." And he looks at me and goes, "It says select, right?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Well, that means select something." So that's what I've done. I've selected something, and that something is what you see here on the screen. We're going to talk about the early church in Rome. And I did tell Jason that this is what I chose. He signed off on it, just so everyone knows. You know, I might make fun of my elders, but I do submit to them. So that's what we're going to talk about today. The Roman Empire cast a shadow over the entire New Testament. This behemoth, this enormous thing, sits in the background of the entire story of the New Testament, Christ, the apostles, and the early church. Roman leaders take part in the trial of Christ. Jewish leaders try to appease their Roman leaders. Paul uses his Roman citizenship to his advantage. Jesus says, "Pay your taxes to Rome," and the money he talks about in his lessons is Roman currency. Inspired writers use Roman leaders to frame their times and their years. Members of the Roman legions are converted to the faith. An entire book of the New Testament is addressed to Christians living in the Roman capital, and we could go on. The Roman Empire is more than just the setting of the New Testament. It is one of the main characters of the New Testament. And yet our idea of Rome, the way we talk about Rome, suffers from one of the same problems that we usually run into when we talk about ancient history. It focuses on the elites. Roman history, when we talk about it, is always about the wars. It's about the conquests. It's about the army, the Caesars, the intrigue, the assassinations, the great fire. How crazy was Nero? How bad was Caligula? So on and so on and so on. And these things are interesting. They're important. We should talk about them. But they are pretty distant from a regular person's experience of what it would have been like to live in Rome. We know from both scriptural and secular history that while some early Christians were wealthy and influential, and we'll talk about some of those this morning, most of them were not. Christianity in the first century was really a grassroots religion, as Mark 12:37 says, gladly heard by the common man. So we're going to ask a few questions this morning. What was it like to be a Christian in Rome in the first century? What was it like to live there, to worship there, to interact with this giant political thing while living the Christian life? And why did this empire choose, eventually, to persecute them? What led the early Christians to be in conflict with their culture and their government? I subtitled this lesson Seeds of Trial because there are a lot of variables, a lot of glimpses we get of circumstances that made things especially difficult for the young church during this time. We're going to look at three particular variables. This is not exhausted by any means, but three particular challenges that the early church in Rome would have dealt with. We're going to look at the challenges of integration, isolation, and communication. And these challenges are connected to each other, and together they can show us a small part of what it must have been like to be a Christian in this place. We're going to use the scripture as our foundation. We're going to use some examples from secular history, some archaeology, some historical documents to illuminate the New Testament accounts, to give us details and color that the people of the time would have understood, but that we in the 21st century miss. So the obvious place for this discussion to start is the letter to the Romans. Now in Romans chapter 1, Paul is making his customary greeting, and he's going to address the Christians in Rome. So let's start reading in verse 7. Romans chapter 1, verse 7. "To all that be in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request, if by any means now at length I might have a prosperous journey by the will of God to come unto you. For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift to the end you may be established, that is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me." So Paul has good things to say about the Romans. Verse 8, he's thankful for them. Verse 9, he's praying for them. I think it's a pretty good thing to have the Apostle Paul praying for you. I would certainly want that. But let's zoom in here on what he says in verse 8 about their faith. He says that it's spoken of throughout the whole world. This tells us first, their faith is strong. That's very good. And whatever Rome is like, however difficult it is to be a Christian there, it is possible. They're doing it. We need to remember that whatever the conditions, the faithful can live and grow. But there are a lot of places that are described as faithful in the New Testament. You know, Philippi comes to mind. So why is Rome spoken of throughout the whole world? For one thing, they're in the capital, and whatever happens in the capital is going to matter. But I think also because it is a particularly challenging place to be a Christian. They're doing a good job, but being a Christian in the city of Rome is going to be difficult. Our first challenge is... I actually have a slide out of order here, so let's go back. Our first challenge is integration. Let's go to Romans chapter 2. We'll read verses 5 through 11 in Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2, verse 5. But after thy hardness and impenitent heart, treasurest up unto thyself wrath against the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, who will render to every man according to his deeds. To them who by patient continuance and well-doing seek for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life, but unto them that are contentious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation, and wrath, tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that doeth evil, of the Jew first, and also of the Gentile. But glory, honor, and peace to every man that worketh good, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile, for there is no respect of persons with God. So our first problem is integration. Paul spends a lot of time in Romans talking about Jews and Gentiles. He does this in other places in the New Testament as well. And the logical reason is that the Romans are having problems with this. Problems between Jews and Gentiles, between the different peoples that make up the church. This is nothing unique, but we can easily imagine how this conflict might have taken on a particular edge in the Gentile capital. In Jerusalem, for example, the Jews were the most dominant ethnicity, and it's just, you know, statistical that the church there would be mostly Jews. But Rome is the most powerful Gentile city, the Gentile city in many ways. This means that if the church is going to grow in Rome, Gentiles are going to have to play a bigger role. So what might the practical, physical, daily aspect of this integration have looked like? To answer this, I want us to talk about a place called the Basilica di San Clemente, which is in Rome. What you see here was first built in the 12th century after one of the many sacks of Rome. San Clemente is a minor basilica. It is the seat of a cardinal, so a moderately important Catholic facility, but those are everywhere in Rome. Here's a map. You can see that it's about 500 yards east of the Colosseum in the old traditional part of Rome. So as we were looking here on this outside here, you'll see that there's not that much unique to see at the beginning. You know, we have some really nice, interesting architecture inside, some art. But again, if you've been to Rome, these things are around every corner. That's nothing that special. Stuff like this is everywhere. But the key phrase here is on the surface. And on the surface is one thing about Rome as a whole that we have to remember. Rome is a city of layers. It has built up on itself over time. Sediment, debris, construction, you know, the river flowing through and bringing stuff down, all kinds of things have combined to make this happen. So today, the ground level in Rome, depending on what part of the city you're in, is somewhere between 18 and 60 feet higher than it was in the time of the New Testament. And so what happened to everything at the old ground level? Well, for the most part, they just built straight over the top of it. And here's where the archaeological process comes in, because San Clemente gets a lot more interesting the second you start going down. In 1857, a guy named Joseph Malulli was the prior of San Clemente, and he decided to start digging. He got down a full layer, basically one story underground, and found what you see here. This is a 4th century Catholic building, that's the 300s. This is clearly very old. And was the original basilica before the current 12th century one from the 1100s was built over the top of it. And as cool as this is, definitely worth exploring and learning about. There's a lot of interesting art and stuff down here too. Malulli was not done because he remembered Rome is a city of layers and he knew one story was not going to be far enough. So what do you find on the next layer down? On the next layer down, you get a set of late 1st century buildings. And these appear to be, depending on what sources you read, there is some dispute over this and some fuzziness around the edges, some combination of aristocratic property, so maybe a Roman villa, part of a apartment complex seems to be down here, and also, what you see here, a Mithraeum, a temple to the pagan god Mithras. That's what you see here. But we're still not done. In the 1910s, a guy named Lewis Nolan was working on a drainage project, I think connecting to something under the Colosseum, and went down even a level further than that. So on this level, we have a first century Roman house that they think was destroyed in the great fire of Nero in AD 64, but it's a little bit hard to tell. Anytime you get back here, you're making some educated guesses. So that's some of what we're doing here. So we've got four layers. We've got the 12th century basilica, the 4th century basilica, the 1st century complex with the pagan temple, and then what looks like the even earlier house. And you can see here kind of an example of what these different levels might have looked like at different time periods. Again, this is a reconstruction, best guess scenario. Now, when we look closely at this house that's on the fourth layer, this is where things get really interesting. This property, best we can tell, was owned by an aristocrat named Titus Flavius Clemens. And this guy was executed in the year AD 95 for being a Christian. Remember his name, we're going to talk about him some more later. But most sources seem to point to the fact that Christian worship took place in his house, and continued to take place there, both before and after he was killed. Most people think that that's why the Catholics eventually decided to put their basilica there. They said, hey, you know, people have been worshiping in this place for a long time, we're gonna take this place and co-opt it. So what this means is that although we cannot prove for sure where the Roman church met in the first century, one of our best guesses is this house 60 feet below the Basilica di San Clemente. That's one of our best guesses. So why are we looking at this in the context of integration between Jews and Gentiles? First of all, if this hypothesis is correct, if the Roman church did meet here at some point in the first century, then that means they met in the house of a Gentile. Remember Acts 10:28. It is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. Jewish members of the church would have been going to a Gentile's house for worship. We can imagine how difficult this might have been for Jewish Christians who were raised a different way. Not only because they were taught not to do it, but also because it would have had some serious social consequences. And we have examples in the New Testament of people getting kicked out of the synagogue for various things. We see that the social pressure was pretty strong. And this could well have led to tensions inside the church between these groups. But also remember that Temple of Mithras that was just around the corner. Gentile worship and Gentile customs were never very far away. Remember, cities like Rome were built at more human scales than ours are. Ours are built, with cars. 5 miles away is 5 minutes away. In this day and time, you know, a quarter mile was 5 minutes away. So you've got to think of this a little bit differently. Everything was a stone's throw away from you. Let's say that you converted a follower of Mithraism. That new convert, you know, his option now might just be turn right instead of left in the hallway in his apartment complex in the morning, and now go down a different hall to where the Christians are worshiping. That's entirely possible scenario. The old ways, the Gentile ways, are just right there, a few feet away. So if you're a Christian in this time, you know, you might have to ask yourself the question, how can I trust this new convert? Literally last week, I saw him down the hall sacrificing to Mithras. You know, is this guy a mole? What's going on? Remember, Mark 3:25, a house divided cannot stand, and that's why Paul spends a lot of time on this. But we see no wonder Jews and Gentiles had tensions when they're all crammed in on top of each other this way. And it's easy to see the kind of external consequences you might get from division as well. Rome was purposefully structured as a multi-ethnic, multinational empire, and cooperation between ethnic groups was key to them maintaining law and order. So what happens when a new religious group appears? They take believers away from Judaism, they take believers away from the traditional religions, they make everybody mad, and then maybe they have ethnic tensions inside as well. So it's no wonder the church became a target. So we see that integration in the Roman church would have been extra difficult, partially because of Jewish custom, partially because of the Roman preference for law and order, and partially because of just how hard it was to physically distance themselves from their old ways, from their old Gentile pagan worship. But distance played a different role in our second point, which is isolation. Because while Christians were not isolated from Gentile society, they couldn't be, they were surrounded by it, they were often isolated from each other. Let's read in Romans chapter 15. Romans chapter 15, we'll start reading in verse 20. Verse 20 says, "Yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build upon another man's foundation. But as it is written, to whom he was not spoken of, they shall see, and they that have not heard shall understand. For which cause also I have been much hindered from coming to you. But now having no more place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come unto you, whensoever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you. For I trust to see you in my journey, and to be brought on my way thitherward by you, if first I be somewhat filled with your company. But now I go into Jerusalem to minister unto the saints. For it hath pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. It hath pleased them verily, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things. When therefore I have performed this and have sealed to them this fruit, I will come by you into Spain. And I am sure that, when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessing of the gospel of Christ. So we remember back in chapter 1, we read that Paul was longing to see the Romans. He really wanted to make this trip. He was praying for a prosperous journey to come to them. Here in chapter 15, he says that he's been hindered from coming by various things, verse 22, but that he still has a great desire to see them, verse 23, and that he trusts that he will be able to do so, verse 24. He then says that he thinks he'll be able to come through Rome as a waypoint on his planned trip to Spain. Now, we know from the book of Acts that Paul did eventually get to Rome, not exactly how he planned it, not on the way to Spain, but as a prisoner of the state. And we remember some of the details and the difficulty that he went through on that trip, you know, stopping in ports, changing boats, storms, shipwreck, snake bites, all kinds of things. And I think we have some innate understanding that it was harder to get around than it was harder to travel. The world was a bigger place, travel was slower, and it was more expensive, relatively speaking, to connect people and things. You know, people were farther apart from each other. But what exactly does that mean? How do we quantify, for our understanding, how hard it was for Paul to get to Rome, or really any of the Christians to get anywhere? Well, we don't have to guess. We're going to use the results of some research, and thankfully, somebody else's research. This is, hopefully we can see everything well, this is a tool called Orbis, and I have lost several hours of my life to this tool. The full name is Orbis, the Stanford Geospatial Model of the Roman World. And you might guess it was made by some researchers at Stanford. And you open it up, you see this. It's a website with a picture of the Mediterranean on it, and here on the left we see several different options. So, what is this? What are we going to do with this? According to their website, it says, Orbis reconstructs the time cost and financial expense associated with a wide range of different types of travel in antiquity. The model is based on a simplified version of the giant network of cities, roads, rivers, and sea lanes that framed movement across the Roman Empire. It broadly reflects conditions around 200 AD, but also covers a few sites and roads created in late antiquity. It goes on to say, our model seeks to improve our understanding of how a large-scale system, such as the Roman Empire, worked, of the effort it took to succeed in the struggle to connect and control tens of millions of people across hundreds and thousands of miles of land and sea. So essentially what you can do with this is you choose a starting and ending point and a time of year, and it will calculate your route, your travel time, and your expense for traveling between those two places during the time of the Roman Empire. So this is Google Maps for ancient Rome. That's what we got here. So let's try it out and see what we can learn that's relevant to our discussion. Now, I've animated this for us because I know that trying to do demos in real time always goes poorly. We'll see how good the videos do. So we're going to start with a medium range one. Okay, hopefully you can see the animation that the mouse is moving. We're going to start with a medium range one that someone in the early church might have done. We're going to do Antioch, Antiochia. This is all in Latin. So we're going to do Antioch to Corinth. So we're going to choose those from the dropdown. We're going to say, when are we traveling? We're going to say summertime. We're going to say we want the fastest option. We don't really care about cheapest or shortest. Let's say our elders have given us a good budget here. And we can do road, river, coastal, sea, open sea. That doesn't really matter to us. We're going to do calculate route. So we're going to watch it calculate, and then I've got a freeze frame here of what it gives us at the end. And we can zoom in on the individual segments of this trip if we want to. You'll notice, for example, we have a stop at Halicarnassus, which would probably be, you know, a fun layover. But the main things I want us to focus on are down here in the bottom left, the time and the cost associated with this trip, which I have zoomed in on for us here. So the fastest journey from Antioch to Corinth in July took 13.9 days. And it covered 1,585 kilometers, that's 985 miles in freedom units, and they were covering about 71 miles a day, best case scenario. And we're driving 75 miles an hour, sometimes a lot faster, and they're going 71 miles a day, best case scenario. But then look over here on your right. We have prices in denarii. We have freight prices, so a kilogram of wheat would have taken around 2 denarii to ship from Antioch to Corinth. But look here, we have per passenger cost is about 385 denarii to travel one way from Antioch to Corinth. Well, how much is that? It's kind of hard to say, but I did find one source that seemed to be pretty reliable that placed the annual pay for a Roman soldier in the year 200, which this model is built around, at 600 denarii. There had been a little inflation since Jesus' time, but it was 600 denarii at this point. So this means that if a soldier's pay was 600 denarii, and we'll say that he's a regular average guy, and he wants to go from Antioch to Corinth, it would have taken him 2 weeks and 8 months' pay. If we convert that to our money, Google said the median per capita income in this country is $43,000. I don't know how accurate that is, but let's just say that it is. If that's the case, then 8 months' pay would be the equivalent of around $28,700 today. I don't know that many of us would be considering a two-week trip that costs $28,000, especially since that's one way. That's one direction. If you want to get back, you can double that. So, you know, basically $56,000 to get to Corinth and back. That's not doable for a whole lot of people. Well, let's do a different one. Let's do the one that is kind of conceptually like what Paul might have done. Let's do Jerusalem to Rome. So we're gonna choose our same options here. We're gonna do Jerusalem starts with an I because they didn't have J's, and then you have Roma. We're gonna calculate the same thing. Summertime, fastest route. Let's say we've got the money we need, and so it gives us this route, which is about what we would expect. We see some waypoints in Greece and stuff like that, and then we're gonna look at our freeze frame here. So let's look at our same numbers for this calculation. We see that it was 28.4 days, so about 4 weeks just to get there one way, if things go well. We've got about 3,200 kilometers, nearly 2,000 miles, again, a brisk pace of 70 miles per day, and 770 denarii, which is well over a year's salary for a one-way trip from Jerusalem to Rome. Again, good luck if you want to get back home. So when we start to look at numbers like this, several things in the New Testament begin to make more sense. We start to understand why it was hard for Paul to get where he wanted to go. He couldn't just drop what he was doing and go to Rome for the weekend. It wasn't going to work that way. We understand better the need, I think, for miraculous revelation. I mean, how else is information going to spread across these kinds of distances? Very slowly and somewhat unreliably. We understand that a lot of poor Jews across the empire, for example, would not have been able to come back to Jerusalem for the feast days. There's just no way. If you're you know, just a regular guy living in Rome and you're a Jew, you're going to spend $100,000 round trip to go back for the feast days? Probably not. Probably not. There's a reason the Ethiopian eunuch was there. He could afford the trip. And we see just how big a deal it would have been to get a letter from Paul or even a visit from Paul, Timothy, or Apollos. So we see that groups of Christians were isolated from each other, both by distance and by cost. What would it have been like to be a Christian in Rome? I think it would have felt pretty isolated. Each congregation would have been an island in a sea of paganism, days, weeks, and really fortunes away from the apostles and from your sister congregations. And then we also begin to see the wisdom of God's plan of church organization here. Do we really think that in this scenario, where it takes months and the equivalent of tens of thousands of dollars to get around, that God's goal was to centralize church authority in one man in Rome? I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, as slow as communication was, as fragile as these networks were, and as expensive as they are, to think that God wanted the city of Rome to be preeminent over the church is just crazy. The early church would not have survived these kinds of distances without the congregational autonomy that we are blessed with in the body of Christ. But there is another side to that coin. Because in the early days of the church, when Christians were few and far between, this isolation made Christianity an easy target for rumors and for lies. And this brings us to our third idea, communication, or really miscommunication. Let's think back to that guy we mentioned earlier, Titus Flavius Clemens. We mentioned that he was executed and that it seemed to be for being a Christian, which is true, but that's not quite the whole story. Let's read an excerpt from Cassius Dio, who was a Roman historian who wrote around the year 200. If you can't read it, that's okay. I'm going to read it for us. Well, this is Cassius Dio writing around the year 200 in his book, Roman History. In the same year, Domitian slew, and best we can tell, this is around 95 AD, along with many others, Flavius Clemens the consul, that's our guy, although he was a cousin and had to wife Flavia Domitilla, who was also a relative of the emperor's. This charge brought against them both was that of atheism, a charge on which many others who drifted into Jewish ways were condemned. Some of these were put to death, and the rest were at least deprived of their property. So Cassius says he wasn't executed for Christianity, he was executed for atheism. What? What could be farther from Christianity than atheism? How do we explain this? And as it turns out, atheism was one of the least nasty things that Christians were accused of. Around 176 or 77 AD, there was a guy named Athenagoras of Athens, and he wrote a document called A Plea for the Christians. Now, Athenagoras was a philosopher, he was a Platonist, he didn't have all his ideas right, but he was somewhat of a Christian apologist. And he wrote this document to the Roman Emperor, Marcus Aurelius, defending Christianity against many of the common accusations that were directed at it. It's a really long document, we're not going to go into all of it, but we are going to look at one short section here from chapter 3 of this document that he wrote. He says, three things are alleged against us: atheism, Thyestean feasts, and Oedipean intercourse. But if these charges are true, spare no class. Proceed at once against our crimes. Destroy us root and branch with our wives and children, if any Christian is found to live like the brutes. Now, the first of these three allegations is a word that we recognize, atheism. We know what that is. We may not yet understand how you can accuse Christians of being atheist, but we'll get to that in a minute and we'll explain. These other two, Thyestean feats and Oedipean intercourse, may not be familiar to us, but they are arguably worse. If you want the gory details, you can go look up each of these in your Greek literature. The plays of Sophocles are a good place to start for that. But for right now, you can take my word for it that Thyestean feasts means cannibalism, and Oedipean intercourse means incest. So, according to the ancient Romans, the three pillars of Christian living were atheism, cannibalism, and incest. That was their picture of Christianity. So we'll go through each of these in turn and try to figure out exactly how so many Romans came up with this warped conception of Christianity. First, atheism. We know that religion in the Roman Empire was polytheistic. Remember Paul walking through Athens in Acts 17? He says, you know, y'all are way too superstitious. Look at all these gods around here. Well, what form did that superstition normally take? Take a look at this. This on the left here is what's called a lararium, and this is one that was found in Pompeii, preserved from the eruption. And this is essentially what a Roman person would have in their house. This is their home shrine, their home worship location, essentially. And here on the right, you have kind of a reconstructed one, because, you know, when you have a volcanic eruption, everything inside it burns up, so the stone is left. But on the right here, you have little carved idols, basically action figures, you could say, of the Roman gods. And these are what you would have in your house and what you would venerate at home. You might choose particular ones you liked more, and those would be the ones that you focused on. But everybody would have some of these in their house. You'd have a few of the gods in your house. So when you convert to Christianity, what are you going to do? You're going to throw out your old gods. You're going to throw out everything that's in the lararium. You're going to empty it out. Maybe you keep it, maybe you don't, but you're at least, it's going to look more like on the left than it does on the right. It's going to be empty. Now your friend comes over to your house. What do they see? Either shrine is gone or shrine is empty. Those are the two options. Either way, no gods. What does no gods equal? Atheist. Let's put it another way. Let's say you're a Christian and your friend asks you whether you think the gods are real, and they start going down the list. Jupiter, you think Jupiter's real? Nah, Jupiter's not real. Neptune? Nope, not real. Mars? Nope, not real. Gods of the Carthaginians? Nope, not real. God of the Jews? Yep, yeah, that one's real. Gods of the Barbarians? Nope, not real. Your friend then says, man, you believe in almost none of the gods. You're basically an atheist. That was their understanding. From the Roman perspective, one God is a lot closer to zero than thousands of gods. And that's why they called Christians atheists. Christians with one God might as well just be atheists. Now, the other two are a little bit trickier. Cannibalism, let's go to John chapter 6. And let's try to put ourselves in the mindset of someone who had never been exposed to Christian ideas before. John chapter 6, and we'll start reading in verse 53. Then Jesus said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, except ye eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, ye have no life in you. Whoso eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood hath eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood dwelleth in me, and I in him. As the living Father has sent me, and I live by the Father, so he that eateth me, even he shall live by me. Now to us, this is obviously figurative. We understand the symbolism of the Lord's Supper. But imagine you're a Roman Gentile in the first century, and you have zero frame of reference for that. You hear there's a new religion across town that meets every Sunday. You say, oh, that's interesting. What do they do when they meet? Well, they said they eat some guy's flesh and drink his blood. They what? So we see how this misunderstanding can take place. And this is the rumor that spread. Now, where does the accusation of incest come from? Let's go to 1 Timothy 5. 1 Timothy 5, verses 1 and 2. Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren. The elder woman as mothers, the younger as sisters, with all purity. Now again, we understand the difference between a spiritual brother or sister and a physical one. But without context, without exposure to Christian ideas that we've had for hundreds of years in our civilization, this is not an obvious distinction to make. In the church, we refer to each other as brother and sister. Your spouses are your spiritual brothers and sisters. That's just how it is. But if a Roman overhears that discussion, overhears a husband or wife calling each other brother and sister, you can see, with no education, how this can be misunderstood. Remember, no one knew anything about Christianity. It was new. It was not part of the culture. There was no established knowledge base to work from. So it seems almost inevitable that, in retrospect, that Christians would be misunderstood to some extent. So let's go to Romans chapter 1. Because I want us to ask what happened when people actually came in contact with Christians. Because, again, let's think about what the Christian is going to feel like. Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 29. Being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful. These are the things they're being accused of. These are the things they've made effort to come out of. So you feel bad about this. You're going to feel like, I'm trying as hard as I can, they're misunderstanding me. But what happened when people actually came in contact with Christians? Not listen to the rumors, not just go through the grapevine. What did they see when they actually came in contact with them? When they replaced rumors with firsthand knowledge, what did they find? Let's go to 1 Peter 1, because we can find an answer from the eastern part of the empire. And in 1 Peter 1, Peter says that he is writing to, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And Bithynia here is the key that we want to focus on. Around the year 110, there was a guy named Pliny the Younger, and he was the governor of Bithynia. And he wrote a fascinating letter to the Roman Emperor Trajan about what to do with some Christians he had found. We're going to read some of this, a fair amount of it, because it is very relevant to what we're discussing, but we are skipping a lot too, so I recommend you go read the whole thing. So applying to the Emperor Trajan in the year 110. It is my practice, my lord, to refer to you all matters concerning which I am in doubt. For who can better give guidance to my hesitation or inform my ignorance? I have never participated in trials of Christians. I therefore do not know what offenses it is the practice to punish or investigate and to what extent. In the case of those who were denounced to me as Christians, I have observed the following procedure. I interrogated these as to whether they were Christians. Those who confessed, I interrogated a second and a third time, threatening them with punishment. Those who persisted, I ordered executed. For I had no doubt that whatever the nature of their creed, stubbornness and inflexible obstinacy surely deserved to be punished. That sounds familiar. There were others possessed of the same folly, but because they were Roman citizens, I signed an order for them to be transferred to Rome. Sounds like Paul. They asserted, however, that the sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and sing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by oath, not to some crime, but not to commit fraud, theft, or adultery, not falsify their trust, nor to refuse to return a trust when called upon to do so. When this was over, it was their custom to depart and to assemble again to partake of food, but ordinary and innocent food. But I discovered nothing else but depraved, excessive superstition. I therefore postponed the investigation and hastened to consult you. For the matter seemed to me to warrant consulting you, especially because of the number involved. It is easy to imagine what a multitude of people can be reformed if an opportunity for repentance is afforded. Now, there's a lot to break down here. First of all, being a Christian is obviously already illegal by this point. He's executing Christians who won't renounce their faith. We see that religion was used as an extension of the state to enforce political loyalty to the Roman Empire. Refusing to worship the Roman gods was seen as disloyalty. It's funny, they hadn't heard of the separation of church and state yet. That's very interesting. We've got a great description of the acts of worship in here. Sounds pretty accurate. Meet together, pray, sing, exhort each other to good works, and then have what looks like a meal to the Roman. That sounds about right. But the most interesting thing to me is that Pliny is unsure of himself. He's not sure how harsh he should be on these Christians. And the reason is, when he looks at them, they're actually not doing anything bad. In fact, all they're doing is meeting one day a week to sing and pray. Are you sure we need to kill these guys? So, when a Roman actually examined Christianity, what did they see? Simple devotion and obedience to the scriptures. That's it. Let's go to Romans chapter 13. We'll read verses 1 and 2. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. We mentioned at the beginning of the lesson that we know Christians were eventually going to be persecuted by Rome. That started at different times, in different parts of the empire. It had different levels of thoroughness. You know, all of that is stuff that we can discuss, but we do know that it happened. And I think now we've seen some of the misunderstandings and the differences that led to that persecution. But I think we also should now have a better understanding of why Paul put this message about submission to government in Romans 13. Remember back to our map of Rome. These Christians lived down the street from the Roman Forum. I mean, it wasn't that big a place at the time. Down the street from the seat of worldly Gentile power. This power was going to torture them and execute them for refusing to renounce Christ and for refusing to bow the knee to Caesar and to his gods. And what does Paul say? Does he say, rebel? Does he say, fight back? You know, take up arms against this tyrannical dictatorship? You know, no taxation without representation? No. He says, submit yourselves anyway. He says, obey the laws anyway. He says, pay your taxes anyway. For all that we like to complain about liberalism or postmodernism or whatever else we're talking about that day, it is pretty easy, relatively speaking, to be a Christian in the United States of America today. It is easy, and that should scare us to death. Because I have to think that if our task is easier than the one the Roman Christians faced, how much harsher will our judgment be if we fail? Now for some concluding thoughts. In Pliny's letter, we read that he called Christianity a depraved, excessive superstition. This idea of superstition meant something very specific in Roman culture. It wasn't just what we think where, you know, like Friday the 13th is bad or whatever. It meant doing or believing more than was necessary. The idea that you actually had to believe and to do was a pretty foreign concept in this time. Essentially, the Romans thought, these Christians are a bunch of tryhards. They care way too much about their religion. It seems like they actually believe the things they say. And would you look at that, they actually act on those beliefs too. When the Romans eventually co-opted Christianity and started to warp it into what we now know as Catholicism, they turned it into something much like the paganism they were used to. They built temples full of icons. They introduced meaningless and repetitive prayers and rituals. They turned it into something that only required obedience and not true belief. They turned it into a tool of oppression, an instrument for the power of their state, an enemy of free thought and truth. It was and is a powerful institution, but it has not won. True Christianity survives. We started this morning by looking at the Basilica di San Clemente, one potential location the Lord's Church may have met in ancient Rome. I got to visit Rome. I did go to that basilica in 2017. I have to say, if you can go to Rome, you have to go. You know, forget Disney World. Drop that. Go to Rome. It's so much better. Clear your plans. It's that good. When I was there, I worshipped with the Lord's Church at a congregation in a street called Via Sannio. And this is the outside of their church building, and here's where it is on Google Maps. Everything was in Italian. I struggled a little bit with that. Had to use my what Latin and Spanish I have to try to decipher the songbook and the PowerPoint the best I could. But it was us. It was the Lord's Church, and they're meeting in Rome today. And wouldn't you know it, they were studying the book of Romans. I think if there was a letter to the Texans, I'd study that pretty often too, you know. But something interesting happens when you zoom out just a little bit on this map. This is where the church meets in Via Sannio, down here at the bottom. Hopefully this is visible enough up there. Yeah, we got our red there. I'm colorblind, so I can't see the red. We've got where the church meets in Via Sannio, and here, about 400 yards away, just around the corner, is the Archbasilica di San Giovanni in Laterano, the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran. Now, we all know about St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican. We recently all saw the new pope elected. We came out on the balcony, gave a speech and whatever, and that's a cool place. You should go there and see it. It's worth seeing. But we don't hear as much about the basilica, the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran, because in Catholicism, it's actually, technically speaking, more important. This is the pope's throne. His actual one, the real one that makes him in Catholicism Bishop of Rome, and therefore head of the Roman Catholic Church. It's not in St. Peter's in the Vatican. It's not there. It's in St. John Lateran. And the Pope's throne is in the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran because St. John Lateran is not just a Catholic building, it is the Catholic building. In fact, it's the only archbasilica in the entire world because it is the official cathedral of the Diocese of Rome. And as such, the seat of the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. This is the inscription on the front of the building. It's in Latin, and translated, this last phrase here says, Mother and Head of all churches in Rome and in the world. So listen to what I am saying. Today, in 2025, the Lord's Church meets 375 yards from the Pope's throne. Right now. I think that's pretty interesting. The early church in Rome faced a lot of problems. They were isolated. They were misunderstood. Ethnic tensions divided them. An oppressive state hemmed them in. We're not quite so isolated today. Communication and travel is pretty easy for us. But the rest of it sounds familiar. We're misunderstood. We are mislabeled. Ethnic and economic tensions still divide the church far too often. And regardless of who is running the government is still not the friend of the church and will not be anytime soon. But we can and will survive. I think we would do well to remember that the Lord's Church is by nature somewhat of a subversive organization. Whether it is paganism, Catholicism, worldliness, what have you. We live and prosper right under the noses of our enemies. Just like in ancient Rome, just like today. The church is and can be everywhere because the gospel is and can be everywhere. I'm thankful that we can look at the things the Roman church went through and we can think it might be difficult, it might be tough. But if we stay true to the scripture, I think we're going to be just fine. Thank you.